Hi, everybody. Good to see you. We've been beginning these recent weeks a series of Sunday messages from the New Testament book of Galatians. It's a letter written by the Apostle Paul to some churches that he began in the region of Galatia, which we'd now refer to as kind of southern Turkey. And the reason he's writing to these churches is to protect them from losing the spiritual freedom and liberty and happiness that they had discovered through the message of Jesus that he'd originally brought them. And so we're finishing the first chapter today. We've been a couple of weeks in it. I'm going to read you from chapter 1, verse 11 to 24, and then we will pray, and then we will get right into it. It says this, "For I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. For I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. If you've heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it, and I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. But when he who had set me apart before I was born and who called me by his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me. But I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days. But I saw none of the other apostles, except James, the Lord's brother. In what I'm writing to you, before God, I do not lie. Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was still unknown in person to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. They only were hearing it said, 'He who used to persecute us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy,' and they glorified God because of me." Some of you know what it's like to feel the need for reassurance from somebody. Perhaps you've been in a situation where somebody's made you a promise and you've believed it and you've trusted it and you've maybe even made some big decisions based on it. And then at some point you've wobbled because you felt as though perhaps they may not be legit. The people that told you their side of the story, were they speaking with authority? Were they valid? That's kind of what may be going on here, it seems. Paul is writing to some churches who've lost their confidence in what he's saying. They've begun to doubt that he is the authority figure that they once thought that he was. And so he's writing to them to try and persuade them that the message he originally gave them was from God. He's saying, "Look, I didn't get this just by listening to a few other people and developing the ideas a bit further. It wasn't that I just picked up some religious ideas from a few of the Christian disciples in Jerusalem and I added a few ingredients of my own to make it more relevant to my own generation. And we ended up with, you know, Christianity is a bit more Paulish than it was because kind of Paul got involved." He's really wanting to remind them and persuade them, no, I got this message direct from the Master. I got this message from heaven. So it has extraordinary authority. It has plumb line authority. You can trust it. You can take it to the bank. You can believe. You can spend your life trusting this. And by the way, this still stands. This is still really important because people these days need to know that the message that Paul preached is legit. And one of the reasons you can be sure that it was actually how dramatic the life change was. What happened to Paul was shocking. It was completely unexpected. It was completely weird. It was completely surprising. No one could have planned it. No one would have expected it. See, this man, if you don't know the story, Saul of Tarsus was his name. And he became a Jewish rabbi at a young age. He was trained by the best senior Jewish teacher of his time, Gamaliel. And he was an extraordinary intellect, and he was a passionate, intense person. And as we said earlier in this passage, he says in verse 13, "You heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it." So this guy is an angry man. He's not just tolerant. He's not just saying, well, we agreed to differ. He was a forceful, violent opponent of Christianity. He was trying to round up Christians to imprison them, torture some of them, and in some cases at least preside over their murder, if not murder them himself. He was a vicious person, hating Christianity. No one could get through to him to explain. I mean, you try telling someone like that about Jesus. Try go up to him and give them a leaflet, or, you know, just could we talk, maybe we could go out for a drink, talk about Jesus. Stop, leave me alone, I don't want that sword in my face. He was violent. It took Jesus himself to deal with him, and Jesus did deal with him while he was on his way to a city called Damascus to round up some Christians to have them imprisoned. It was while he was on his way there that he was taken off his horse or donkey, whatever it was he was riding, and had this extraordinary vision of the risen from the dead Jesus. And his life was never the same afterwards. He was utterly transformed by that moment. It changed him completely, dramatically. And this is worth telling. He tells this story fairly often. In the book of Acts, he tells it a few times. Here in Galatians, he tells it again. One or two other letters, he mentions it. Why? Well, one reason he tells it is so that we can be sure that this is real. This stuff is real. Some of you, you've seen someone's life change. Maybe you've seen someone's life change dramatically. Sometimes the stories people tell of how they become Christians, you hear the story and you think, how can someone not believe in Christianity after that story? It is astonishing. One of my friends was a violent drug dealer and thief and became a Christian in prison. Honestly, the story of his life, you just, when you hear it, you just think, how can there not be a risen Jesus from what happened to this man? Such a horrible person and so changed by the love of Jesus, utterly transformed. Well, the Apostle Paul was like that story on steroids. It was like to the extreme. And actually, what happened to him had to happen dramatically because there's no other way it could happen. No one could have got through. Some people have become Christians because they've looked at the evidence of Paul's life, or Saul of Tarsus's life. Saul was his Jewish name. Paul is the name that he used as he traveled amongst Gentile, non-Jewish people. They've looked at the story of his life and concluded that Christianity is true because of what happened to him. It can't be explained any other way. And it may be that you need to hear that story yourself to understand how significant Christianity's claims are. You need to realize that this isn't just nice ideas that people have suggested. This is throw you off your horse stuff. This is dramatic. If Jesus isn't real, we have to find another explanation for what happened to Saul of Tarsus. And I can't think of one, can you? It just doesn't make sense that this dramatic transformation would take place. And a lot of historians, secular historians, would say, well, we know something happened. We know something happened. They don't always want to become Christians, so they don't say that he met Jesus, because that would admit that Jesus is alive from the dead. But we know something happened. Well, I put it to you that we need to find a good conclusion. The most, it seems to me, reasonable one is to say that Jesus really met him. That's a kind of parenthesis. That's not quite in the sermon. I just thought I'd throw that in to help you to consider the claims of Christ for yourself if you've not already done so. What I want to do with the rest of this message is look more at what Paul is trying to do in almost a sideways fashion in this little bit of writing. What he's trying to do here, subtly it seems to me, is compare and contrast the Paul pre-Jesus and the Paul post-Jesus. So you've got pre-Jesus, Paul, post-Jesus, Paul. What's the differences? What kind of personalities do we see on display? What characteristics come through? And the reason he's doing it in these verses is because he's saying to the churches in Galatia, listen, you guys, if you go towards the Jewish religion and the rituals and the externals and the ceremonies of the Jewish religion that these other Jewish Christian teachers are encouraging you to adopt, you just need to know what that will bring to you as people and as a community. You need to understand the route you're taking. You need to know where that path leads. See, what's been happening, and this is a bit of backstory for you so you understand the context of his writing. These churches in Galatia have listened to Paul. They've turned to Jesus. Paul's gone to plant other churches in other cities. These Galatian Christians are now listening to other teachers from other places, mostly from Jerusalem, or claiming to be from Jerusalem, who are saying to them, yeah, Paul's Christianity only took you so far. It was like a kind of 0.6 on the scale. You need a little bit more of our style of Christianity to get you properly Jesused up. You know, we're going to get you hardcore Jesused up. We're going to help you to really get properly plugged into Jesus. And the way they would do it, the means for the proper hardcore Christianizing, was going back to the Jewish rituals, basically to make them more Jewish Christians. Not just Christians, but more Jewish. Now, you and I might, in our day, think, well, what's the harm? Why is that such a bad thing? It's nice to be diverse. It's good to learn from the past, have traditions. This is surely a good thing. We can be tolerant of that. Paul does not think so. He's saying, no. That is not, that's a deal breaker. We're not going there at all. Do not go that way. Because he knows, and he's going to spend the whole of these six chapters, this whole letter, which we're going through over weeks, explaining to them why it's so harmful, why it's so dangerous, why it's not a small thing, it's a massive thing. He wants them to see the danger of the route that they might be considering at this stage. Which is why this letter is such a dramatic, such a fierce polemic. It's why he argues with such force, because he's concerned they're going to miss the whole point. They're going to throw away their freedom. They're going to throw away their freedom for religion. Jesus comes into our lives to bring the gift of God's grace. And we must never, ever, ever dream of exchanging that for religion, for ritual, for ceremony, for externals, for just keeping rules, keeping up appearances, doing something so feeble, so powerless as going back to religious law. So I want to try and compare these two ways, if you like, of doing Christianity, you could say, although one of them isn't Christianity at all. And that's looking at religion and then looking at what we call grace, but the word could be just as easily translated as gift. So let's look at Paul before Jesus, when he's, you would certainly call him religious. Paul under religion. There's three things that I notice in these verses I read about characteristics of the pre-Jesus Paul, the religious Paul. The first one is there in verse 14, for example. He says, I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. So the first thing I notice here is that if I pursue religion, if I allow myself to be kept by religion, I'm going to live my life needing approval. Okay, so that's the first characteristic. I seek approval. I need approval terribly. Why do I say that? Well, I can kind of see it. I hope you can, in the way he's describing himself in that verse. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. What does that tell you about the guy? He's driven. He's ambitious, but he's ambitious really for his own achievement, for his own performance, for his stature, for his sense of greatness, his sense of accomplishment, his sense of greatness in comparison to the others around him. I was doing so well amongst my own peers. I stood out. I was advancing beyond them. And he says that, you know, so extremely zealous was I. In other words, you know, I took this so seriously. I was passionate. I was pouring out every second of every minute, every hour, every day, every week, every month, every year of my life was given over to this great goal of advancing beyond other people. Because what matters most surely is that we advance beyond other people. We rejoice in our own success and we weep at other people's success. We might not say so, but we do. And we secretly cry when they do really, really well. And we secretly rejoice when they fail, That's the kind of personality that you, there's other places in the New Testament where you can see him describing this kind of thing as well. But basically, that's kind of underneath the skin of religion anyway. It tends to be there in human beings anyway. It's part of our nature. But religion definitely doesn't sort of set us free from that. Religion more seems to exacerbate that characteristic. It makes us more like that. It doesn't stop us from needing approval. One of my friends says that when she started to become a religious person, before she really met Jesus, she said she describes herself as an approval-seeking missile. That's a brilliant description. That's what a human being can be. I must be approved of. We take that into our relationships. I must have you approve of me. I want you to like me. I want you to be impressed with me desperately. Are we any of us like this? Trust me, standing here in front of a few hundred people, it's kind of a temptation for me, I have to say. That's why we do video preaching in this church, so I don't have to see all the faces that I'm preaching to, whose approval I need. That's not the reason we do video preaching, just so you know. There's other reasons too. But this is a major part of our temptation, the normal common experience that we face of, do you like me? Do you approve of me? Do you affirm me? Will you tell me that I'm good? Will you be for me? And the truth is that when you get into that frame of mind in your relationships, it actually stops you being able to love people. You don't really love people whose approval you're desperately needing all the time. How can you? You're not there to serve them. You're there so that they will serve you. They're there to serve you. If the way you're treating them is as a means to an end, the giver of a commodity called approval, I must have your approval. Well, you're not seeing them as someone to love. You're seeing them as someone basically to get from. I must have your approval. And think about it. If you're in that way relating to the people around you, then surely there's at least a danger that you'll relate to God in just the same way. God himself is the one whose approval you crave all the time, but not in a healthy way. You see God as someone who you've basically got to impress. I've got to show you, I've got to prove to you, I've got to win you over somehow. And sometimes, without meaning to, Christians, preachers, churches can add to that feeling and make it less and less healthy. Jesus was asked once by an expert in the law of the Old Testament, what's the most important commandment in the whole Bible? Tell us, Master. Tell us. What's the most important commandment? Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. You shall love the Lord your God. All your heart. And ever since he said it, people all over the world have been going, oh yes, excellent command. Good choice, Jesus. That's a good choice. That's what I would have said, yes. Love the Lord your God. That's a good command. One of my favorites always has been, I like to think I do that very well. Yeah, love the Lord with all my heart, with all my mind. Yes, I think loving God is a very noble achievement, to love God, to truly be a lover of God. And I like to think of myself as a great lover of God. And it sounds great. It's on Thought for the Day or Songs of Praise. It sounds great in those kind of sort of twee sentimental contexts. But the truth is, friends, if you try loving God for just 10 minutes, you'll probably start hating him. It's true. If you try loving someone that you don't know, try loving this God who demands that you love him. How is he lovely? How is that appealing? How is that attractive? Love me now. I will kill you if you don't. That's how it comes across. So I've got to love him. Okay, oh, I really will love you. I'll really try. I love you more than she does. And he doesn't love you at all, but I really do. And it gets all kind of tense and sweaty and desperate, and we're trying to impress God. Within a short time, we're quite oppressed with it. I don't love him. I can't impress him. I can't win his approval. I can't. We see God as someone who we're basically letting down. It's basically who he is. Basically, I'm disappointing him. How can I love someone who I constantly have this feeling that he's demanding something from me I can't give him? That's who he is. I can't win him over. Well, you can try to love him. You can sing songs about loving him. You can try to impress. You go to church on Sunday and say, I love God, I love God. But friends, honestly, do you? Well, no, I don't. Honestly, really, do you love that God? Of course you don't. You don't. You don't love that God. You can't. You've got to see him as lovely if you're going to love him. You've got to see what he's like. You've got to be won over. So religion just leaves us needing approval. Interestingly, it's not just going to be that that we see. We also see that it leaves us craving kind of tribal badges, tribal boundaries, tribal ways of showing that we belong. It leaves us concerned about the tribe, the party line. It makes us very concerned about the boundaries and who's in and who's out. Are we keeping to the rules? How do we tell if you're one of God's people or not? How can we know that you're in the tribe? How can we be sure that you're one of us? And that was what the rules were all about in this situation. The Galatians were in danger of going down this route where it was all about, are you circumcised? Do you keep the food laws? Do you keep the Sabbath? Those are the things that we see in this letter. They're getting obsessive about a few particulars, a few rituals. If you do these things, you're in. And Paul wants to say to them, you look at it there in verse 14 again, he wants to say, I've been there. I know exactly what this lifestyle is like. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. I was so passionate about the traditions of my fathers. It meant so much to me. Because we I guess crave a sense of cultural identity, belonging to the tribe. Knowing that we're in, knowing that he's out and she's out, we are crossing the right things off the list. We're ticking the right boxes. We're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. We're in. Kept the ritualistic rules and we're in. And those people haven't. And it creates a certain sense of pride within us when we feel we're in the tribe. It also creates a certain kind of contempt for others who are outside of it, or certainly those who are on the edge of it, certainly those who claim to be in, but they haven't really kept the rules properly. We feel contempt for them. We feel aloof. We feel superior. We feel above them. This is frankly what racism is. Or any kind of ethnic prejudice, any kind of tribal prejudice, any kind of class prejudice, any kind of education or non-education level of prejudice. It's the strata to which I belong, the people I run with are above you. This creeps into all kinds of societies. It creeps into churches. We are the this party, you are the that party. And it doesn't just split people up in a kind of soft edges way, it can become brutal, it can become intense, it can become highly emotional, because the badges that we have that clue people up as to our identity are often things that mean an enormous amount to us. They're not small issues. They can be things that we fought for politically over generations. It's not a small thing, for example, that these people, the Jewish teachers of the time said you shouldn't eat non-kosher foods. You should only eat the Jewish foods. You shouldn't eat Gentile food. Don't eat with Gentiles. Why was that important? Well, I'll give you a clue. One of the reasons it was important was that in only a couple of generations before, in other words, within kind of folklore family memory, there were the stories of the people during the Greek Hellenistic conquest of Jerusalem who had rounded up some of the young Jewish leaders and said to them, you must now eat this non-kosher food. We will watch you. You will eat pork. You will do it. And they said, no, we won't. So, right, we'll force you to. You try forcing us. We won't do it. We'll torture you. We won't do it. We will torture you to death. We still won't do it. They had stories of that. Young people who died refusing just to eat. It was just a little silly thing, what food you eat. Who cares? These people cared. Because it was about their families. It was about blood. It was about identity. It was about being fierce and strong and a sense of identity. We are the noble race that would not yield to the pagan kings and emperors and generals. We wouldn't yield. When it came to blood, when it came to death, we did not yield. You can hear the pride, can't you? You hear the sense of tribal pride And then Paul hears about these people that are turning to Jesus and claiming to be the people of God, and they're eating pork. They're eating non-kosher food. They're not going to the temple. They're not obeying the Sabbath. And they're not being circumcised. This is massive for him. It's not small. It's huge. It's huge. And friends, we need to understand this because it explains so much behavior, so much religious behavior. When people feel that their boundaries are being threatened, that the traditions are being threatened, they will lose it. So we see that characteristic here as well. I need to move on to the third and final thing that is shown in this story here. You see, the way that Paul talks about himself is quite revealing. You see the language. He says in verse 13, "You've heard about my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. And I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers." You get the tone of that? What kind of words came out quite often? Words like "I," "my." This guy's very, very aware of his own sense of responsibility. See, religion will tend to make us to think that we fix the world. It's our responsibility. I've got to do it. I have got to fix things. I have got to set everything straight. It's my responsibility. That's what you see here. This is a man who's fighting against the world to try and set it straight. It's like he feels that he's God's only man. God needs me. I'm faithful. I'm pure. I'm genuine. I'm the real deal. I'm authentic. I'm the only one left. I've got to fight for God because no one else will. God needs me. I've got to set everything straight. I've got to work hard to put the world right. Religious people will often fall into that way of thinking. It might start with something very noble, but it becomes something, in Paul's case, it became something violent, hateful. Because we can't imagine that the world will go right if we don't fix it. I've got to fix this person. I've got to set them straight. I've got to nail them. I've got to tell them that this isn't, you should never do that. If I don't stop them doing it, if I don't force them to stop, then God won't be honored. I've got to fix this. Here you see another classic characteristic, and it's all over his language in those verses. Well, we're going to move on to the other side of the equation, if you like, or the other side of this table. But obviously, everything changes for this man because of who he met. Everything changes, deep inward changes, transformation right at the core of who he is. He is completely transformed. And in his case, it happened overnight, just suddenly. I don't know many people who've had that experience. Maybe some people have. Maybe one of you. Maybe one day some of you were, you know, getting on a, not on a horse, but I don't know, on a plane or getting in a cab to go and tell someone to stop being a Christian. And on the way, you met Jesus and became a Christian. Who knows? Maybe that's someone's story in this place. Not many stories quite like that. I know that there are people who, like, there's many imams in Muslim-majority countries who are becoming Christians these days, and they're saying it's because they have dreams of Jesus when they're in bed at night. There's some dramatic stories that go on, some amazing stories, but generally it's a little slower. Generally there are a few stages. There's a process that takes place, generally. And even though it's a process, even though it's slowed down, I want you to know it's basically the same thing. It's basically the point where you realize he's bigger than me. I'm not what I thought I was. I'm weak. I am so weak. I'm so dependent on him. That's what goes on in his life. He's riding up to Damascus, breathing out threats, finding Christians to lock up and destroy. He's desperate to close this thing down. He's fighting all his life. What happens? Jesus meets him. He falls to the ground. He's blinded. For 3 days, he couldn't see anything. He was utterly shocked to the core, overwhelmed. Well, no, that's not happened to me. Not anything quite that dramatic, but I want you to know something like that has happened to me over time, and it will happen to everyone who gets to know Jesus. It will. What's happening is God is dismantling our conceit, our pride, our self-confidence, our sense that it's down to us to fix the world. This is what he's full of. Jesus has to set him free from it. He has to realize this life I'm living, this way I'm trying to win approval, this way I'm trying to impress is actually doing the opposite. Like someone that sends in a reference for a job, you know, with his CV, and it turns out the reference is saying something quite unhelpful. I had a friend of mine tell me a story of that. He said he was sending a reference with his CV, this person, and he never read the reference. He wasn't allowed to. The reference actually said, "Whatever you do, do not hire this man." And Paul's kind of going around his life just kind of giving out this reference. You know, he's trying to impress, and actually what's happening is he's draining his life of any meaningful relationship with God. His life's been a disaster in terms of actually serving God. He's been so desperately trying to save the world for God, he doesn't know God. Doesn't know him at all. He needs to actually meet him. He needs to have an encounter with him. He needs to experience his gift of grace for himself. He needs to find himself knowing the kindness of God. And I wonder, I've just in these last few minutes before we stand together and worship God as we will shortly, if I can help you to consider your position, whether you actually live on that religious side of the table or on the grace side, on the gift side. Have you understood that God has brought a gift into your life, that he wants you to know him through the gift of his son, Jesus Christ? There are some key characteristics. There are some big differences. So on the law side, I seek approval. The grace side, God's approval overwhelms me. God's approval kind of drowns my need for approval. All this desperate kind of heat-seeking, approval-seeking missile heart that I've got, it kind of falls into the sea. It's like I don't live that way anymore because I found what my life was always meant to be about. I found this person who chooses to approve of me irrespective of how well I've performed. He just does. He just utterly approves of me. He's completely for me. He won't be shaken off. If you look at the language that he uses, it's really important we notice what he says here. Verse 15, after he's described his hideous past, he says in verse 15, "When he who had set me apart before I was born and who called me by his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me." Now that is just a massive, it's not even a finished sentence, but he said enough in there to keep us going for weeks. That is a lot contained in those words. "He who set me apart in his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me." God the Father is pleased to show mercy to his children. He's pleased to. He's not being arm twisted. He's not being bribed or blackmailed. He's not saying, "Well, you've worked so hard, I have to approve of you now. All right, you've got my approval. You won me over. Well done. Well done. You did very, very well. I'm very impressed. I feel obliged now. I don't really want to because I don't really like you, but I feel obliged to love you." Is that how it works? He was pleased to reveal his son to me. I tell you, this is massive, isn't it? Pleased to. See, Paul's done everything that you'd think would be possible to turn Jesus off. Done everything. He's tried to do everything possible to impress God. And this is great because Paul's an example of both then. He's an example of both. He's the guy who tries really hard to be the top religious, top of the class, most religious person, therefore God has to let him in, and it doesn't work. God won't let him in because of that. And he's the worst possible guy who you think that God would never let in because he's such a hideous sinner. And Jesus does let him in. So he proves to us that you can't be too wicked for God, neither can you be so good that you are acceptable to God. He's failed on both counts. And yet God is pleased to love him. God is pleased to. He chooses to. There's a verse in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, where God speaks to his people in the Old Testament. He says to them, it's not because you were a great people that I loved you. It's not because you were a great nation. You were a weak nation. You were a feeble nation. You were a small nation. He says, I loved you because I loved you. This is the way he deals with us. He loves out of who he is, not out of who we are. It's all out of, you can't actually debate him. You can't argue him out of it. You can't. I mean, even the language he uses, he says, from before I was born. So it's like you can't really argue someone who's made up his mind before you were born. Everything that I've done in my life is irrelevant. My whole CV, yeah, we're not concentrating on that. We're concentrating on stuff before you were born. Oh, I can't really fix that. Okay, well, that's when we did the decision, before you were born. So everything else, everything post-birth is irrelevant. That's it. That's the gift of God. It's approval that overwhelms. If it hasn't overwhelmed us, I wonder if we've seen it. If you've never actually been so taken aback by the gift of God to you. If you've never been so overwhelmed by the graciousness of God to you, you personally. I don't mean, oh, he so loves people. He so loves the world. No, you. If you never stopped and just wondered that he loves you and believed it, just trusted it, just received it as a gift. Well, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. I'm not saying you can't. Maybe you can today. I pray that you will. He wants you to understand. His grace is overwhelming. It's not reasonable. It's not proportionate. It's out of proportion. It's not everything. You know, we intuitively imagine how much God should love us. We're wrong. We're wrong. We're always wrong. That's why this letter's in the Bible. That's why we're spending weeks in it. So we get detoxed. You're going to keep hearing this message continually because we so need to be transformed by the true grace of God. It has more power than anything that Paul is preaching against in this story. The second characteristic that he's got on display here, you know, he was talking about tribal badges. Well, he starts talking about the church as his new tribe. Really, that's what he's saying. I persecuted the church of God. These were people he would have despised. But now he realizes, I belong to this church. And this church isn't in one tribe. It's not one ethnic group. It's not those who are circumcised and keep the rules. It's everybody who belongs to Jesus. And they're all different. They're all different colors, different backgrounds, different lifestyles. They're just so different. And they're so different, and yet they belong to Jesus Christ. What does it mean? It means I get to learn from all kinds of people. See, somebody who's really met with Jesus Christ will have an ability to be patient with people who are completely different to them. They'll have an ability to listen and learn with people who don't fit their normal social category. If you only ever stick with your tribe, with your kinds of people, you never listen to anyone, you've got nothing to learn from anyone who's just like you in every predictable way. Now, I want to suggest you may need to meet Jesus because he'll set you free from that. And you'll belong, you realize, to a people that are radically different, so diverse. And you'll celebrate it. You'll think, wow, this is good. This is a good thing. And finally, just very quickly, this last characteristic. Where previously he's tried to fix the world and not done well, he meets a God who by his sheer grace, by his sheer gift, redeems our worst messes. Paul's story, don't forget what he said. He who set me apart before I was born and prepared me. He prepared him. He prepares Paul. How does he prepare him? He sets him apart as an apostle by training him. The things that happened in Paul's life, even the things that we would look at and say, that's a disaster, that's a mess, that can't go right, it's awful. Paul spent his life trying to destroy Jesus. You'd think Jesus would sort of maybe forgive him and let him into the church, which is kind of shocking in itself, but kind of say, yeah, well, you're in, but we got a lot of damage repair to do now. It's a real mess, Paul, and I don't know if I can fix this. You've really made things very difficult for me. I know I'm God and everything, but you've made it very hard for me to run the universe because you really ruined things for me. It's never like that. Not even the worst things, the things that we do to Jesus that are awful, in some extraordinary, gracious, wise, cosmically powerful way that only God understands, he's able to turn even the wounds we inflict on him in our favor. He's able to turn it into something good. You know that this is exactly what Christianity is all about. The Bible says that we, sinful people, who crucified Jesus, we were doing it. The Bible's very explicit about it. The human race crucified Jesus. It's something that was a bad, horrific, horrendous thing. What was happening? God was using the worst possible thing that mankind could do for something beautiful, for something good and wonderful. Isn't that extraordinary? The things that people mean for harm, God means for good. God can use, God can even ordain the worst things that humanity can perform for something beautiful, for something eternally good, something you can ultimately rejoice in. And this is such good news for us. I imagine Paul spent his life thinking, what horrors I was guilty of, what atrocities I was responsible for, and could still rejoice knowing God not just forgave him, but God could turn even evil for good. I guess there's going to be some people listening to this here today or listening or watching this on screens and thinking, but could God turn my evil for good? Could the mess I've made, the ruin I've brought into the world? Well, here's the thing. You can either be like Paul and carry on trying to fix the world religiously, selfishly, self-sufficiently, and making no improvements at all. Or you can trust Jesus Christ, put him first, see him as the Savior, see him as the one who will fix everything. Trust him, let him be Lord, let him be in command, let him be in control of your life and see what he can do, see how he can redeem even some of the most damaged situations. That's what he did for this man, that's what he'll do for any who truly trust him. He works all things together for good to those who love him and who are called according to his purpose.